Welcome to Ahead of the Game, a podcast brought to you by the Digital Marketing Institute. I'm your host, Will Francis, and today I'll be talking to Brian Herron. Brian is the director and principal designer at Dublin-based UX agency Each and Other. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Will. Great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. I'm really glad you're here, actually, because this is a subject we've been wanting to cover for a long time. UX, user experience. When we get into the heart of it, I really want to kind of mine your brain for those core principles and thoughts and ideas around UX. Okay, so let's start. You just give me your high level explanation of UX. What is it?
So let's talk about the goal of it first, right? So the goal ultimately of UX is to create better products, better digital products. We do that by focusing in what your customer groups actually care about, what their needs are, what their goals are. So we use user-centered data or user-centered mindset or user-centered approach to ultimately come up with better ways of doing things, better ways of developing apps, developing websites, all of that digital stuff. So that's like the purpose or the goal. That's why it exists. but I do think that the terminology that we use can be confusing. And I think that there's lots of different jargony acronyms thrown around. So maybe it might be good just to lay out at the outset what it actually is and go beyond its goal or purpose, right? Because at the start, you were alluding to the fact that maybe it's kind of visual, right? And I'm not sure I would necessarily 100% agree that UX is, right? So let's try and tease it out a bit, if you'll indulge me.
Oh, I'd love that.
When you think of a user interface, UI, right? That is everything that you see, that is everything you touch, that is everything you interact with, right? And most of the time when we think about UX, that's what people mean. They mean what the way the website looked what your tapping at on the app on your phone or whatever. We might also think that there's another thing called CX, right? This is the sense of all of the loyalty you've built up, the actual feeling that people have of doing business with you. This is like the big ticket items about what makes your business particularly special, right? The customer experience that you want to create. Like Amazon, for instance, the classic example is that one-click purchase idea, right? This idea that transactions can become incredibly simple. And we have a UI element, which is like the button that you pick, right? That is the orange button that you click for one-click purchase. In between, there's what we call UX. And UX isn't really... Buzz there on my phone. So UX isn't really a thing, I would say. It's more of a process. It's a way of understanding the CX that you want to create, the experience that you're trying to get to, and then matching it up a way or a mechanic to get to a UI that's actually really effective. So we have a whole load of tips and tricks and all sorts of things that we do to make that work. But ultimately, it comes down to making decisions based on real customer data. It comes down to involving subject matter experts or stakeholders, whatever layer of the company they're actually at, not just listening to the people with big wage packets. And then finally, we prototype and test ideas to make sure that they're going to be effective. And really, that's all that UX is. It's a way of making decisions. It's a way of parsing out the impact that we want to achieve for the business and then ultimately turning it into user interface. And it's that bit in the middle. It's just a mindset. It's just a process. And even though, you know, we trade on it and we try to make it sound very exciting, it's a very simple set of ideas in the end.
So what's the deliverable? What lands on my desk when I've hired your agency? I'm imagining it's things like wireframes.
Yeah. Well, other than the bill, of course, Will, which is critical.
Oh, the bill. Yes.
But before the bill comes, look, we create these things. We create these assets. Sometimes we call them design trophies, right? Because we need to show that we're working. We need to show that we're doing something. But we create stuff that's visual, right? We do create the screens of what apps should look like. We do make annotations or describe how interaction should take place. We do make prototypes that people can hold in their hand and click and work through as if they're real things. But that's the end result. That's the user interface. The way we go about creating that, I think, is where the actual importance of what we do is. And ultimately, it's the way that we're actually able to create the effect that we want, right? Following this process allows you to de-risk major initiatives. It allows you to get a higher chance that your products are going to be successful. And it goes beyond just an execution work of like, let's make a quick screen together, but actually figuring out from start to finish, what is the best screen that we can create and why should we create it in the first place?
Right. So that's all to do with making life as easy as possible for the user, the customer. And I suppose, therefore, it's an inherently very audience-centric discipline, right?
Yeah. I mean, Yes, absolutely. That's like the cornerstone, or the, I guess, when UX started to emerge as a discipline that people were paying attention to, that was the bit that was missing. We had business incentive, we had technology and its various levers and incentives that were built in there. We had the capabilities that allowed us to do it and have significant change and capability, but we didn't have the audience, right? So that's what UX, it seeks to readdress an imbalance in the way that software, websites, apps were created. So while we often think of UX as a purely user-centric discipline, it's probably slightly incorrect. It more redresses a balance and brings the user back into process where they weren't invited in before, or their needs weren't really taken into account and the balances of the business. So I would still say that it sits at a point where it's trying to interpret business need, it's trying to interpret what technology can accomplish, but now we also bring in that extra component. Yes, it's what is unique about user interface, or at least that's its primary purpose in the flow of things. But I wouldn't say that it should be viewed solely as a completely user-centric discipline. I think if you're doing that, you can end up in some pretty dodgy commercial territory.
Why is that?
So we take the example of airlines, right? The classic example is that they try and sell us more stuff than we actually need as we go through the process, right? They try and upsell us on baggage. They try and upsell us on seating. They sometimes try and trick you into buying insurance, or at least it's in a gray area, right? Those are incentives that are coming through from the business, right? So the business is trying to say, well, this is what's important. If we take that away and say, hey, we're customer centric, we don't want these things, well, then we're going to leave a bit of a hole in the potential for the bottom line, and we're not creating, you know, shareholder value. So there's definitely like a tension there, right? UX should sit on the side of the customer, right? UX should sit on the side of saying, this is the experience we want to create. But it's not the only driver in a business environment. And I think we have to accept that. I mean, the companies we like to work with are ones that want that customer centricity, that are trying to bring it in, or trying to do something more dynamic and saying, well, we think there's a win-win here. If we serve the customer really well, we will get the business benefit on the back of that. So I would be saying that that is largely true. And I think the best businesses are run that way. But there are other pressures on businesses that need to be taken into account, and different pressures and different commercial reasons about why things might be done. So, yeah, UX has UX's purpose within a business environment ultimately is to produce commercial benefit, right? But the discipline's heart and soul remains around creating better experiences.
Yeah, I'd say that's in a lot of ways like marketing, right? You know, of course, we're trying to sell things. But at the same time, if we don't create something that has inherent value for the customers out there, then it's not going to do its job in bringing that commercial value in, right?
Yeah, not in the long run, right? There are exceptions, you know, if it's price-driven alone, right? In any competitive market, where there's choice, where there are pressures above and beyond price alone, there is a tendency towards a better experience coming along and people voting with their feet or being inspired by something they've seen elsewhere in a different industry and saying, yes, actually, if that was applied to my industry, we could make a quantum leap forward in what we could offer our customers. So I think overall, there is a tendency towards better customer experience, but that is not an even curve or an even arc towards that scenario. We have all sorts of things that put pressure on those experiences. Commercial incentive, regulatory pressure can make experience, at least on a surface level, worse as well. So there are like a series of other considerations that come into play there. But look, you're right. Essentially, when we create product or when we market a product, we want all those things aligned. We want to create a great product that makes it easier to sell and get out there, right? So I think that there's fundamental connections, even though we sit almost on different sides of the divide in customer experience, where really good marketers in really good companies and really good UXers ideally are aligned in what they're trying to create. And they have a very clear vision about what that means for a user of a digital product.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So what I'd like to know is kind of how clients arrive at you and what you do for them. So I suppose there's three questions here. How do people know they need you? And the second question is going to be, what problem do they often turn up with? And my third question is going to be, what is the process? I mean, obviously, every client's different, but what is the typical, if you were to have to nail that down, process that people would go through, or that you would go through in doing UX? Sorry to reduce it like that. But anyway, so let's start with, how do people know that they need to come to you?
Yeah. So what we used to find back in the olden days when we started doing this, you know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, whatever it was, we were doing an awful lot of education, right? We were defining and saying, well, this is the promise that UX can make. And then trying to get people to buy into that. And you know, frankly, it was a lot of hard work. The market has changed significantly, right? So there's now a much more educated buyer out there. There is an acceptance that UX, even though not a full understanding of what it is, there's an acceptance that it seems to be important, particularly in a digital capacity. And so that sort of education piece is less of a chore or less needed, I think, most of the time. People come to us for a variety of reasons. Often it's the case, let's break it down into two categories. Category one is that they have a product, the start of a product, the idea of a product, a broken product, and they do not have the internal skills to bring this forward, at least in the short term. And they come to us as experts with a strong track record to say, you know, Brian, I need your team to come in and we need to reimagine what we're doing here because our competitors are eating our lunch, or because we know ourselves that we're just not getting the value for our product, or we need to do this new thing. It's really complicated. We can't figure it out. Let's figure out how this is going to work in market. So that's the first sort of cohort of companies with a defined need and clarity over what they want to do. And I would say a lot of the people in that block are people who have done digital product for many, many years and have not used UX processes before, and they have gotten burned in different ways. They now understand, well, spending an extra few weeks indulging this process is more likely to make this a success. So that's sort of category one. This is our digital product people. And when I use digital product, like I'm talking about, you know, SaaS companies. I'm talking about companies with large digital estates that are creating things. And ultimately, that's what they're selling. They're selling digital product. So that's a really exciting place for us to work in. The second area, or the second type of profile of customer that's really coming in, is a customer that's at a moment of deep change in their organization and may have an inkling about what they need to do, but don't have the evidence, surety, confidence that the market is actually moving in that direction. So this is where we might be doing significant amounts of research work, discovery work to define that market need, what their pain points are, what their goals are, and then try to articulate what their product or services should be. Where are the current problems and where does it need to go to over the next five years or so? So those are sort of the two main categories of why people are coming towards us.
And just really break that down into basics. Did they actually go, we're a e-commerce business and we've read about industry standard conversion rates. So we've heard at a conference what some other similar businesses were saying their conversion rates are, and ours are like half that. You know, have they come with those sort of problems that are very specific?
That's often, so you can think of it like an instigating moment. Someone's panicking about something.
So
usually there's a defined moment that they spotted on a journey that they're concerned about in some way. Now, we're a little like plumbers, right? We can go in and look at that particular problem, but it's very likely that we're going to encounter other things along the way, because the way we work and the way we research, the way we look at things is much more holistic, right?
Going to cost you.
Well, you know, we're very reasonable. Well, you know, and really it's not about the price. It's about the value you get, right? So we do get these people who are coming in at certain moments and saying, hey, this is a part of our journey that's broken. We think we need to up it. Or as the example you gave there, people are coming in, they're saying, look, the data is showing us there's an issue here. Please help us figure out what we need to do. And the problems are going to break down in that particular example, in this sort of conversion example, it's probably going to break down into things that can be solved on site, right? It's things that are going to be, it's not an area of expertise, but areas where we might point to in terms of like the kinds of traffic that are coming in, we'll be able to spot problems like that and work with teams to understand what that might be, even though we're maybe not best positioned to solve that. Or we're going to look at further in the chain. Why aren't people coming back? Or why are people not fulfilling? Or why is customer fulfilling their final purchase? Why are customer satisfaction low over time? And we can start to look at that next stage of the funnel. So our job is not just to look, we view it as not just to look at the site, but look, understand fully that customer experience so that we can, you know, help companies start to think beyond just the data that's available to them on Google Analytics or something. And of course, look, that's taking what's very relevant to this audience. In terms of how sales get made online, we would probably have higher expertise in B2B conversion overall, because the sales process tends to be really complicated, right? The kinds of decision making that goes into selling to businesses or selling complex software to businesses, that's a really human decision in the end, right? It's not just an impulse purchase and trying to make an e-commerce flow work rapidly and efficiently and get the tailoring of the price and reduce barriers and worries in people's minds before they click to purchase. But in B2B software or B2B sales, often there's a whole load of process, procurement, different stages of sales, demos, onboarding that are going in that's kind of hidden underneath. And that ends up being a very exciting area for us because it's very human in the sales process. It's very labor intensive and it's full of ambiguity. And those are areas where we're able to often help businesses start to connect better with who their customers really are. And then we often find that those sort of recommendations actually start to influence digital product as well. So if you can understand what your customers want to hear on your site in terms of messages, why people are actually buying your product instead of why you think they're buying your product, that can often have a huge knock-on effect in your product strategy itself, which is, again, you know, an area where we like to be.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? So your process is you go in and you troubleshoot, essentially, a bit like a plumber or anyone else. You're diagnosing, right? You're trying to find where and you're probably looking for the lowest hanging fruit, I imagine.
Yeah, the mythical silver bullet, Will. The one thing that we need to change, the one quick fix that will change the landscape, yeah.
Yeah, there will, I mean, but there are on. I mean, I'm trying to just map this to my experience running an ad agency where, if you're doing that deeper piece of work, you'd go in, and obviously there are longer term things and recommendations, things that are probably beyond your scope, you know, that you need deep organizational changes that need to make, all the way down to some quick wins, which can help win a client over and just prove to them that there's some value in this relationship, even though some of it you're going to have to wait a while to see. So do you sort of think like that at all, or?
No, absolutely. Yeah, 100% all the time, right? Because you said the word troubleshoot. Like a large portion of our business is when someone's hitting the emergency button, something's gone wrong, and it is a case of like, okay, we know we haven't started this off correctly, but please come in and help us shepherd this through and land the plane, so to speak. So yeah, we're always working under restrictions, right? Sometimes these are self-imposed restrictions. The businesses don't have the imagination or to change, right? But then equally, it's like there's just realities in technology. There's realities in market. There's realities in budget. So we would always class ourselves as designers, right? So UX design, right? So design works when there are restrictions. It works when there are constraints. That's its whole purpose. And so we would look at where those limitations are and start to map out. Yeah, okay, well, here's the top five things that we need to change now. And in terms of solutions, here's the easiest three or four ways of resolving them. There are more complex ways. There are more longer term ways where those solutions can be solved in a better way, but they're not available to you right now. And that's okay, because we need to be looking what can be implemented in the short term. You know, what's a 4-week kind of a gig to see if we can get some uplift, get some traction, prove that we're on the right track, versus what's the longer term project that underpins this. So frankly, you know, we are starting to move into a market where what we might call those tactical style projects are going to become more important. Companies have done well for the last 10 years, so they have budgets, but they're also going to need to be cautious about where the spend comes in, and they need to be careful about where they're placing their bets. So when we went through the last recession, whatever that was, how many years ago? I don't want to think about it. But you know, the projects that we saw around that period of time were things that were tactical. There were things that you were looking at what is the art of the possible in this shorter period of time? What can be done within the limitations that we have because our CapEx isn't there, but while still we can get some benefit and start to look at the numbers that are critical to us, cost to serve numbers or revenue or whatever else it is. And look at those in a tactical way, without having to worry about, you know, deep digital transformation or infrastructural change underneath that. And that's completely legitimate, right? I think the job of UX, again, is not to create the perfect thing. It's to follow a process to get you as close to the good result that you're looking for as we possibly can.
Hello, a quick reminder from me that if you're enjoying our podcast series, why not become a member of the DMI so that you can enjoy loads more content from webinars and case studies to toolkits and more real-life insights from the world of digital marketing. Head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com/aheadofthegame to sign up for free. Now back to the podcast. What brands are the go-to examples who are doing this really well, UX?
I don't have any secret or special knowledge, by and large. I live in the same world that you live in. So the things that I'm interacting with that I'm appreciating and finding inspirational are probably the same things that you are. And the same things that you're finding frustrating are probably the same things as well. So we've gone through these periods of where the focus on UX has ramped up like significantly, right? And so what I find gratifying is when in a business that I'm not expecting it, a company is able to provide a moment of service or a moment of experience that I find surprisingly easy, where they ported in ideas from elsewhere, right? So, and these are moments that you will have experienced as well, right? The first time that a cab comes, and back in the day when it was Halo in Dublin, but equally Uber, same sort of idea, and it just appears. And suddenly that's what we call a shifting baseline. Straight away, our expectations about how transport works in an entire city shifts and changes almost overnight. And that sort of immediacy of service gets applied to all sorts of other industries. I was experiencing something the other day that I found a DHL return package, which had an awful user interface. If anyone from DHL is listening, I'd be very happy to talk them through my experience. So as a user interface, this return package thing was actually quite annoying to use and a bit confusing, but the service was far exceeded my expectations. I printed out the label and the delivery guy was over 4 hours later and picked up my package and it was just gone, right? So I think that when we look at how services work, I don't think it's just about the single magic interaction. Oh, suddenly I can send money easily through Revolut, right? I think it's about the stacking of user interface with service and creating experiences that I actually was quite surprised at how DHL managed it. And even the fact that the user interface was not good as empirically as a form that I had to fill in, but the experience overall was really positive. So I think, you know, the things that I'm looking for is when those industries that I traditionally don't expect to be good are able to circumvent that and change that very slightly and introduce something that feels like a positive experience, particularly when I wasn't expecting it.
When you're having your meetings just on a day-to-day basis, are there companies that get talked about, like, you know, that have really great digital UX and are often referred to and copied and mimicked, whether that's some of the big apps, some of the big streaming platforms, content platforms? You know, are there some that just regularly referenced in your work?
Yeah, so there are, but again, it's the ones that you would expect, right? People want an experience like Airbnb, right? They want what they call an Apple experience, although I think we can quibble about exactly what they mean by that. So they talk about these things and they talk less about the specifics of what that is and more about the feeling that those brands and those experiences are able to create for them. So often we need to retool and re-engineer. Well, what do they actually mean by Airbnb? And by and large, they're not really talking about the technical aspects of how selection gets made, the process or steps that a person would go through for booking. They're really talking about the impact and the feeling that this company was able to create and set a position for itself in an industry. So I think there is a sort of a bridging process that we need to understand between what, when clients are saying or giving us an example of this is really cool, often what they mean is like, overall, I feel really great and positive towards this experience, but they may not be able to articulate why. So like some of the references that we would use, we would always sort of, you know, look at problems we're facing in two ways. One are, when we're sort of mapping out the landscape, right? We would look at direct competitors, right? So, and that would be international as well. So if we were doing a government site for, I don't know, healthcare service or something, we would be looking at what health services are doing globally, how they're managing those things, what kind of, how that maps out, how they're talking, what kind of services they provide. We would do all that kind of work. But we might also look at other industries or other examples of complex networks or sites, like, for instance, universities, right, have incredibly vast digital estates and have all sorts of services. So maybe we look at a university as well. So not just trying to be ingrained in terms of what's happening in your specific industry, in your particular neck of the e-commerce world or whatever else it is, we'll be looking at many other inspirations from other industries, from other geographies, so that we can start to map out, well, these companies are solving similar problems, technical problems. They're trying to do similar things in digital ways, even though they're completely unrelated in terms of the market they're serving or the product they have. So we tend to be quite agnostic in terms of the inspirations that are coming in. And I would say that sort of process, the hunting out of good UX, the hunting out of clever implementations, is actually quite a large part of our early stage engagement with clients.
Of course, yeah. What do you think about Shopify? Do you think that an e-commerce brand is taking a risk by not using Shopify because of the really seamless UX of their entire checkout process?
So, for disclosure, we have worked with Shopify in the past. E-commerce platforms would have had to do so much on their own to create infrastructure to for servers, for databases, and join together all these things in the background to make something unique that works for them. So every e-commerce site was completely different. And then layer by layer, we have these industrial style CMSs that start coming in that are baked in and effective for e-commerce. Magento. We have a layer of things coming in like Shopify, which take away so much of the decision-making from you, that have a standard but high quality experience in terms of user experience and what you might expect and the toolkit that you would want straight out of the box, right? So it takes away so much of that concern and worry. Another good example, for instance, I was working on a client recently in the learning space, and they were talking about building their own, you know, essentially their own learning management system. And I was like, you're crazy. Just there are options here. It may not be vastly cheaper to go down this road, but there's so much decision making, so much weight, and your emphasis and focus should be on the learning, the educational material that you're creating. Similarly, if you're on a digital platform for e-commerce, where do you want to spend your money? Is the soul of your business, is it the platform, or is the soul of the business the product that you're selling and the way that you're selling it and the way that you're shaping the customer experience overall and the way that you're curating your product range and pricing it, right? That to me is closer to where the effort and thought process should be going in from a marketeer working in that area. So I think from a business perspective, options like Shopify, similar solutions across other industries are enormously valuable because of the headspace that it just takes out, right? You've got a single neck to ring for that problem.
Well, that's it. That's my wider point, really. It's to, you know, a lot of digital companies or companies with any digital presence will be thinking, to what extent do I build stuff myself, whether it's a learning management system, an e-commerce platform? And I think that as the years have gone on, there's more pressure on us to adopt these platforms because it's a winner-takes-all economy. And if you look at Shopify, I mean, you say and other solutions, there isn't another solution like Shopify where you can go to a random store you've never seen before, and then when you hit checkout, they send you a verification code on your phone. You put it into your computer, which is automated pretty much these days, and boom, they've got all your shipping information, your name, your credit card details and everything. And there's no other platform that's so widespread. And we had similar discussions about WordPress, didn't we, all those years ago, and those kind of platforms. And so I'm just interested to what extent you as a UX agency would recommend that, or are you kind of like, no, everything must be bespoke and handcrafted and, you know.
No, well, look, that's, you know, those sort of bespoke or handcrafted solutions, the tricky problems are of course, where my business helps, right? So when we see solutions that are in play that are really high quality, like Shopify, obviously that cuts out like a potential customer for us, at least to a certain extent, in terms of the larger scale interactions, the big stuff in terms of how this should operate. But you know what? That's fine. I would often recommend these platforms, or at least recommend them as part of discovery. I think anyone embarking on a large scale digital product themselves to build from the ground up really needs to know what is specific and unique about that, what they want to implement, before they write a single line of code, or even before they invest in, you know, expensive discovery or UX processes, right? You know, you need to be really confident that there's some reason for you to own this from the ground up. And there's something absolutely unique that that can't be replicated in any other way, because the products exist. And if the product exists and the product is good enough, the headspace that you're going to get back by going with one of these platforms is enormous. And that has real value. There are areas where the companies that we work with in product space primarily tend to be companies that are building, you know, the next Shopify in their area, right? They're building the underlying pieces. They're building the B2B tools that, and maybe it's in agritech, or maybe it's in healthcare, or maybe it's in financial services, but they're building the platform that they want to sell and plug into businesses. And that's where we found a really good market for ourselves, because those products tend to be very complicated, and that's where we can help.
And they do have a deep UX need, because what they do really hangs off the UX, because they're essentially selling that on, like Shopify have done, as the product, right? And then selling that as a key benefit.
And if to relate this back to marketing, I suppose, is that when we work with products like that, there are a number of different layers where that user experience becomes an amplifying effect and a positive virtuous circle in terms of what's being produced. So you end up, I mentioned this earlier, like this idea of like really understanding what your customers care about means a great B2B website that connects with your customers. Understanding how your customers buy means a really good sales process and onboarding experience. Making and investing in a high quality interface that fits your user needs means an amazing demo when you show it to the customer, an amazing dashboard so they understand, oh my God, I'd love to have all this information in front of me to express so clearly. And then ultimately workflows that when they go and you get embedded into your organization, workflows that save you time or that actually produce the business benefit that you're expecting to get from this software, which then of course leads to more cases, more referrals, and ultimately higher revenues for businesses that start to, you know, gain the benefit of ultimately having a good product that's easy to sell. So, you know, that's certainly an area. So I'm not too worried that these platforms exist. I'm not too worried, for instance, about internal teams that are working very hard and some great internal products coming in, you know, large banks and elsewhere. Because I feel like there's something, we offer something unique in our space, and it's not right for every business. And you know what, from my perspective, that's okay. But what I would be banging the table on, I think, is fundamentally the need to understand what your customers really care about, and how the tools you're using affect them and how they're being used in the real world in context. And for that, there is an element, always a need for some degree of UX and UX process to make sure that the decisions that you're making on the company side are actually going to have the impact that you want and ultimately result in the business benefits you want.
Okay, cool. Well, I want to touch on some of that stuff, understanding the audience and prototyping. So let's think about that first. It's obviously been a mantra of the tech industry for years, this fail fast, fail often, you know, ship it, and MVP, minimum viable product. So basically get the most basic version of it out to people quickly to validate ideas. And that has found its way into marketing. It's relevant to our listeners here because, again, we're told, like, don't spend $1 million on the campaign without doing any validation. Try that at a small scale. Try creating a few bits of content, see if there's interest around that, you know, amongst the audience and how they like to consume that and have that presented to them, right? So that is clearly a good idea and a good way of working. Tell me how you go about validating ideas through prototyping.
Oh, we're really getting down to the weeds now, aren't we, Will? So
we are.
So let's get our worldviews locked down first. So, you know, when we think of how research works, so let's get a little bit technical, because our audience, I'm sure, is well able for it. We have essentially like a couple of continuums that we work on. We have attitudinal and we have observational, right? What people say and what people do, right? That's the first sort of lens we look through. And the second lens is we have quantitative and qualitative, right? So numbers, essentially, and then declarations, what people are saying, sound, image, everything else, right? Where UX tends to favor is in an area where market research maybe doesn't have quite the same sort of at least prevalence on a very wide scale. And that is in observation, observational qualitative, right? So that means that we are watching what small sets of people do, right? The reason why is because the prototypes we're working on don't actually work a lot of the time, right? We're giving people things that we use software to kind of hang together in a janky sort of way, but we can't give the tools out to 1,000 people or 10,000 people to use because they're not fully functional a lot of the time. They're too early.
So you're using these kind of like clickable mockups, like using InVision or a similar type of product?
Similar. Well, yeah, Figma is the de facto tool at the moment. It has a lot of weaknesses in it in terms of the interaction that it's able to do. So there are other tools that we can deploy depending on what we want to know, but we're trying to mimic the experience of a user interacting with a piece of software, but it's not connected to the back end. It's not connected to databases by and large. So instead, we're kind of going through a process to get feedback, to understand, are we on the right track? What needs to be changed about it, right? And so we're sitting down, well, and these days it's all remote, but we're watching people, much like a Zoom call, we're watching people what people do on their screens, we're watching their faces, and we're having a conversation as they go through it. So this is sort of what a classic user test is. We use that information then, small sample sizes usually, to make inferences about what are the big ticket items that need to be changed. Really what we're asking first and foremost is like, are we near the mark? Did we execute right on what our discovery work told us we needed to do? And then what are the actual changes we need to make to enhance and improve that experience? So what happens then is like in an ideal world, we're going through that cycle multiple times. So the more important your software is, the more investment you're making, the more times you should do that process to make sure that what you're producing is on point. As you go through development cycles, as the product actually starts to get built, as it becomes more functional, you are opening yourself up to testing with larger cohorts of people, potentially in live or staging environments, which means that it potentially has the ability, for instance, to, you know, buy something or add something to a basket very clearly or more choice for users. So you can go through these stages. The point about prototyping, I guess, is that you're testing with real users early and as often as you can. And at each stage, you're doing it before it gets to the next expensive stage of investment, right? So we're testing.
Yeah, minimum risk, basically.
Minimum risk, yeah. And the early stages, there is no risk other than, you know, time. Yeah, so you're using all that information then to plow into decisions. And what should happen then over time is that your product gets better and better and more focused and slicker. So the core tasks continuously get better to the point where you're, you know, there's diminishing returns. We really feel like that we've reached the point where the route that we've taken is fairly optimized. And the only way for us to know further if that's working is for us to get into what we would call A/B testing or some other sort of live test where we're putting it out to cohorts of people and then comparing and contrasting maybe against a previous version to see if it has the effect that we want. And that sort of testing, I'm sure, will be very familiar to anyone in digital marketing.
Yes, it is. But of course, you're presenting people with digital experiences. So the experience of subscribing or shopping or downloading or just interacting with something. And then what do you do? Do you kind of survey them afterwards? Or do you just look at how they behaved using the thing?
Yeah, so you're looking to try and acquire as much data as you can, but where do we place the emphasis on that data? So so do we acquire attitudinal data or survey reactions? Yes, we do. How much emphasis do we put on that? Not as much as we do on the observational things, right? So I can, you know, almost every user test I've ever run, I'll have someone who's like cursing and really frustrated about the workflow that they're going through. And it's fine if we've made mistakes, that's okay. That's what we're there to uncover. And then at the end, you'll say, how's the experience? And they'll say, oh, it's fine. You know, it's 4 out of 5. And it's like, and that's where the weakness of declarative data comes in, because people have, you know, they're trying to make you happy, or there's some other bias coming in, or they don't even notice what's happening. So having those two data points is important, because we can sort of say, well, you know, here's what people say, and here's the delta. Here's what we believe we observed as we went through it. Here's the timing difference in terms of what it took them to get through. Here's the pattern of where people ran into trouble. And that observational data really is the ultimately the key difference, I would say. The purpose of what we're doing versus market research is far more focused on the improvement and optimization, obviously, on product, and then the high degree of emphasis that we place on that sort of observational quality of data being the primary thing that we're most important, that's most important for us to look at.
Because ultimately that obviously points more faithfully, you know, the stuff that where you look at the metrics of how people actually use things and how much time it took them, that is going to bear the closest relationship to how much more profitable a company comes, you know, because their digital product's better, right? I do understand that.
And there's a lot of maturity in you know, marketing and e-commerce, for instance, in terms of analytics, right? So UX and analytics, analytics being observational as a data tool, right, just at a large scale, there's a hand-in-glove action and reaction between those two things. So we would often work with analytics teams and do our own work in this area where we're looking to spot the patterns at scale. Where would we think the issues are? And what a UX process brings to that on, and layers on top of it is like, okay, well, why are these things happening? And what is the likely solution? So the numbers are going to tell you where problems are and potentially what's happening. UX and qualitative, once you lay that in, is probably going to bring you much, much closer to what's really happening with consumers, and very, very quickly lead you to what will suddenly feel like obvious answers about what to do. So what you often find in analytics, and when people are sitting at their desks looking at the numbers, is that they'll spot a problem, they'll come up with one or two ideas, and then they'll try and immediately act on it. What UX would say was like, okay, you spot the number of problems, but let's really figure out that our next action is the right one to take. And that will involve a little bit of trying to get a bit closer to real customers to make decisions.
Okay, cool. I think I'm getting under the skin of what you do and the process, the value of it. So give me a sense of where it's moving, maybe even like where UX has been and how it's arrived here briefly, and then where it seems to be going, what looks to be the future of UX.
This is the million-euro question now, Will. Where are things going? So UX, right, has a... Its history is one of piracy in many ways, right? So the things that we're doing, we robbed from industrial design, you know, the classic product design, people who made real things. Like we robbed a lot of their techniques and some from market research and started to apply them to digital. So we're talking about sort of the late 90s is this first idea from it, human-computer interactions. And then, you know, throughout the 2000s, it sort of grows up. Really, it's when we hit mobile that this starts to become a much bigger issue because, you know, we suddenly have small device sizes. They're so personal. We have the massive escalation of computers from, if you remember, like, you know, we're sort of talking 2006, 2007. Even then, laptops or whatever weren't fully embedded. But once we get mobile phones, we're talking about mass market distribution in a way that we never really experienced before. And it's at that moment, that's really our inflection point in sort of, you know, 2009 onwards, where we see this huge interest, influence, and shaping of UX. And when we have that influence coming from, you know, B2C products that are coming through from, you know, the big players in that area, that sort of washes back on our expectations about what other types of software should look like as well. So we're kind of nearing the end of a cycle here in this regard. The tools that we have are more mature. In many ways, a lot of the designers that we have at the moment don't have the sort of experiences that I've accrued over the last while because there's been more things available. There are just better examples of UX out there. So, and we have mature internal teams in place. So what happens next is change is going to happen in the industry. We have a lot of things that are happening in new fields which are coming through. VR seems very... up until last week, felt very old-fashioned, a year old, but now Apple's launched its headset, and now we're back into a world where this seems like a viable future. So there's going to be systemic change now in terms of how spatial user interfaces should look, and I think there's going to be a long track in terms of that experience. There's a lot of really interesting things that are happening that are inherent and specific to AR and VR that weren't possible before, and I think is a genuinely exciting area, even though it's likely to remain niche for the foreseeable future. And of course, the other area is in how artificial intelligence will be deployed in effective ways. And that's going to happen in at least two areas. The first is in one, the actual tools that I use on a day-to-day basis, the efficiency with which I can complete tasks, how efficiently I can create screens. There is a lot of like repetition and rote work that we need to do to create these sort of digital products. You can imagine how a lot of that can compress.
Yeah, like if you've got an app with 72 different states and screens and you've just moved a button and you're like, you need to tell an AI, can you move that button on the other 71 versions of this screen?
Yes. So and that's a skill set in itself to maintain and organize design systems, to create screens rapidly on the back of like what ultimately are simple enough instructions, but end up being quite complex tasks to drive a complex program like Figma. So we're definitely going to see change there. But then additionally, we have this whole layer of like potentially the simplifying of interface, right? So I mentioned at the start that UI is how interfaces work, and we are moving at least in part to a text-driven interface world, right? You know, the work that, you know, the demos we're seeing coming through from Adobe at the moment that require all you to do is input a sentence, and then your brain is making a choice. Is this right or wrong? I'll change it or not. But we no longer need 20, 40, 100 different tool sets and the knowledge to how to use them correctly. So the idea of interface may decline or at least converge on a fewer number of things. I don't think it changes the need for UX, what people want to do with this, what kind of impact should we be trying to create with these products. But it does have a lot of knock-on effect in terms of how important UI will become over time. So we have, you know, there's certainly a lot of change in the area.
Do you think your job's at risk? Like, do you think I should tell my son to go into UX, you know, in 15, 20 years' time?
So the question is, will there remain human problems to solve, right? So the question is, human solvable problems. Like, are companies still going to have trouble making decisions? Is there still going to be a market in terms of customers and a need for technology to fit against them? Like the things that we're doing in UX have to be pulled away, I think, from the app that's being created, right? Again, it's a process about how we connect customer experience to the customer. So, or the customer experience we want to create to the customer to resolve a business benefit. So I think that the idea that this industry will be always creating apps and screens, I think that's at risk. But I'm not sure I perceive in its entirety the risk that we are going to remove human problems from technology entirely.
And like you said before, the computer-human interface, there's always going to be a mediator there, whether it's clickable apps and screens, whether it's voice commands,
yeah,
which we'll all have to learn however smart they are. There'll be good and bad ways to use that technology and for that technology to work for us. So however that technology interfaces with us, we'll need some level of design based on research and strategy, right? I get that, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Although so I think that's exactly my point and more succinctly laid out, I think, than I was making it, Will. But it's hard to see what that future looks like exactly. I think change is absolutely going to be part of it and accelerate. But I think fundamentally the skills about trying to understand what customer behavior means, interpret that and understand what the use cases for technology should be. I think those problems remain. Does it mean that there's a place for companies like mine to continue to grow and to solve problems for businesses? Well, I hope so. But sure, we'll flip those cards over when they come.
We will. We'll all be forced to flip some cards over, I think, and probably keep doing it as the various developments and waves of developments land at our shores. Well, you know what? We've taken up plenty of your time. That was very interesting. Now, as you know, when we get to the end of a podcast episode with someone, I do like to try and boil down all that we've talked about into practical tips for our listeners, because I like the idea that our listeners can go away and do very specific things. So I'm not going to nail you down on a number, 3, 4, or 5, whatever, a handful, let's say. Do you have a few tips that people can go away and do immediately to start becoming more mindful and thoughtful and start, you know, proactively improving perhaps even the user experience they provide to their customers and their audience?
So let's think of the really simple controllable things, right? So the first thing that I would do is that I would deeply analyze what competitors in your space are doing, right? I would sort of track through your journey by yourself, desktop and mobile, right? So go through the two of them and treat them as separate things, and make a list of where is important, what are the key moments in your journey, and give an assessment about how you think you're doing just on the face of it. And then pick direct competitors in your market that you know you're competing with, and maybe other people who are solving similar types of problems or similar styles of problems. Pick three, four, five, six of those businesses and just conduct a little benchmarking exercise to see against the things are the journey points that are important in your experience. How are the others doing, right? And make a list and try and turn it into like a little bit of a Notion document or a Word document or Google Doc or whatever it is. Just write it up and try and get screen grabs and some degree of record. You know, so that something that I'd be looking for there is like, what can I tell? Who's got better messaging, right? Who's explaining their product better, for instance? Is there anything, if I was in e-commerce, is there anything specific about their maybe sizing or in terms of how they're handling delivery that is reassuring the customer? If I was looking in B2B, I'd be looking at what's their demo or what's their guided tour like. You know, can I see their interface and get a feel for their product? So that's the first thing I would do. And that's not an exercise that has to take a lot of time. But what you're going to get from it is either potentially very scared, right? But you're also going to be able to spot in a little bit more of a formal way that where those opportunities might be for a next step, right? So that's the first thing. You're trying to put yourself in the eyes of the customer. The next thing I would do is I would actually just try and run a user test, right? I would try and, without getting too formal about it, and there are a lot of sort of... tough things that go into, you know, trying to get unbiased qualitative data. But there's nothing better than just asking, you know, someone that you know to try and use the software for the first time and just let the just sit back and watch how they do it. Just get them to talk through what they're experiencing, what they're seeing for the first time.
Literally just sit with them whilst they use your website or app or something.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, someone that you trust well enough that they're going to be honest with you, which is important. And just let them run through it without interjecting, without trying to help them, without cajoling them, just run through and try and record a couple of their experiences. And it's not going to be scientific, right? It's not going to be data you will change your whole company on. But what you're trying to do is to step a little bit closer in away from your day-to-day worries about, you know, where traffic's coming from and conversion rates and into the mind of the user and what they're experiencing. So I think there are two really simple things. I mean, what your next steps after that is probably looking at your analytics and seeing if you can spot points in your journey that are not effective or that are broken, and then matching it back against your data sources and your qualitative that you just connected. So you're using analytics then to see if it matches up to what you just experienced. So I think really simply competitor benchmarking, trying to run one or two user tests yourself, and then matching up to see if your analytics journeys correspond to what you've just uncovered in those exercises. You know, that's a day's work, maybe two, if you're very enthusiastic or very thorough. And the whole exercise really is trying to step into the mind of the customer and put yourself in their shoes just a little bit closer. And that often has a really strong business benefit.
Brilliant. I think that's sound advice. Brian, thanks so much. I really appreciate you sharing all your knowledge today. That was really insightful, fantastic stuff. There is, of course, one more question for you. Where can people find you and connect with you online?
LinkedIn is probably best. So Brian Heron with two O's, each another.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again. Hope to chat to you again soon. Cheers, Brian.
Cheers, Will. Thanks.
If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about transforming your marketing career through certified online training, head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com. Thanks for listening.